Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 80. Melissa's joining me. What do you think about that, Melissa?
That's impressive.
Yeah, I know. We're going to do something big for 100. We have to figure that out. We'll get there.
I can't wait for that. I think we should do a live broadcast.
Well, we'll see about the logistics of that.
I've put it out there now. It's got to happen.
Yep. All right. So you did, but now I have to follow through on that. All right. This episode features Brian Grill, who I have known. He was one of the CG supervisors. Actually, no, he was the DFX supervisor on my first film I ever worked on, which was Day After Tomorrow. He is one of the kindest, most wonderful people in visual effects. I would call him the Tom Hanks of visual effects.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
What a compliment.
He is wonderful, wonderful person. I absolutely adore him. And he has earned every single bit of respect and honor that he has done because he has fought for it from the ground up. And I really, really respect how he has done that. There's no luck involved. It is all skill and all determination, and his determination is great. You guys will hear it. You just have to hear the podcast to really understand how amazing he is and why I love him so much. He is a visual effects supervisor at Scanline. I should let you guys know that. He's done several things. He's also an Academy member. He's been nominated for 2 Oscars. And he is also been at Digital Domain for years before that. So that's where I knew him and where we became really good friends. So really glad that he came on. And we can't wait to have you guys listen to podcasts. But there is some very cool, important announcements, which is Melissa is waiting to tell you about.
I need a fanfare.
Yeah. And because SIGGRAPH is coming up, and when this podcast goes up, it'll be only about a week away. So, Melissa, tell us about all the cool things we're going to be doing at SIGGRAPH on V-Ray Days.
I've got notes because there's so much going on.
Okay. You can run through the notes.
We've got our very popular V-Ray Days back at SIGGRAPH this year.
Yes.
We've got room 205A. Booked out for the Tuesday and Wednesday.
Okay, Tuesday, Wednesday, 205A. All right.
Yep. That's it. Make a note. We'll be on their app. All of our talks are actually up online now on our SIGGRAPH page. So if the viewers want to look up SIGGRAPH2016.chaosgroup.com, they can get a full rundown of all the talks on there. But there's 11 of them. There's a lot.
11 talks.
11 talks over the 2 days.
Okay.
We've got some fantastic companies, Scanline being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Atomic Fiction, Blur, Pixelmondo, Digital Domain, Encore, Fuse FX. I could go on.
Yeah. No, please do.
There's a lot.
I think obviously there's a lot of great visual effects companies that are going to be presenting some really great stuff.
I know. We're so grateful for all the speakers.
Blur, I think, did you mention Blur is going to do some really cool stuff on some game cinematics?
Yeah, on the Halo game trailer that premiered at E3.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be a good one.
I'm very excited also about the No Zone presentation.
Yes.
Tristan is presenting, I believe, for that, right?
He is. It's going to be more of a demonstration, I think, more than a talk. As well, so it'd be interesting to see that live.
He's pretty cool. Nozone does some really interesting VR work, which is I think the best word for it is volumetric VR, which allows you to sort of move around and see photorealistic renderings.
Fully immersive,
and allows and it works with V-Ray. So those of you who are interested in that kind of technology should definitely come check that out.
Bit of a show and tell there, I think.
Yeah, cool.
Should be good. And we've got at 10 o'clock on the Wednesday, there's our V-Ray for Educators breakfast.
Oh, okay.
So if any of the listeners are involved in education, there's a link on our website where they can go and register for that.
Great.
So our education team will be there to talk about all things V-Ray and in education.
They've been working really hard to create a lot of great content and workflows that help the educators learn how to work with V-Ray. So it's really, really great stuff.
And our co-founder, Vlado, will be there doing a special presentation on the Tuesday.
I'm sure that will be very popular.
Yes,
so Vlado will be presenting the latest and coolest stuff in V-Ray.
It's a little insight into what's going on in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
We could take longer than an hour, I should think, for that one.
Yeah.
But it'll be good. I'm excited to see that. But check out the website.
Yep.
All the details are on there.
Again,
there's a registration link for anyone that's interested.
Yeah, at SIGGRAPH2016.chaosgroup.com.
That's right.
Yep. Great. All right, guys. Thanks so much. Hope to see you guys at SIGGRAPH.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So I should note to people that we are currently drinking Oban. And there's a specific reason why we're drinking Oban. Because on Stealth, and we can talk about Stealth a little bit more later, but on Stealth, you were, as people will soon find out, you're one of the most generous people I know in the industry. Definitely. And you would care deeply about the people that work for you. And we were working very long hours, and you'd bought a bottle of Oban. You bought a bunch of things that people you knew would like, that appreciate. Just, you know, you'd find a character, like, that person would like this. I'm going to get that for that person. That person would like this. You get that for that person. And you would go to Costco and buy a bunch of
things. Wednesdays, middle of the week. It was always a tradition.
Yep. And you would go to get the Oban, and you would put it on a shelf that was a little bit high because you knew that I was a little bit taller. And so I knew it was there. And Rory McLeish and I would go.
Rory,
who is a very, very Scottish person and had a very thick Scottish accent, which it took me about a year till I could truly understand what he was always telling me. But he was a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he'd always come up to me and say, "Chris, should we get a wee bit of scotch after dinner?" And so we'd always hit the Oban. I remembered it very, and it was one of those things. It was like, wow, Brian is such a kind person. I remember that specifically. We were two projects we worked on, Day After Tomorrow and Stealth, right? And you always were very generous and very complimentary to people.
Well, I mean, the big thing for me was, you know, when you have the right producer, you don't have to sometimes go out of your way to get, you know, there was just such a crunch. I was like, really? Come on. We're putting these hours in.
Yep.
And just took it upon myself, because I guess the way I look at it is, you know, you want to treat people the way you want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And except, you know, after you've had too many drinks, then, you know, all
bets go off. Yeah.
But you try your best. And and that was important, because we were. I mean, I believe, you know, we were working 6 days a week on Stealth.
14 hours, yeah.
Yeah, crazy, you know, getting the lighting pipeline and getting that all going, because it was like in transition.
Yep.
And it took a lot of work.
But we're trying new things. I think we're trying to champositing for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it was exciting, and everybody was working on it. And the funny thing was, I mean, you think about Stealth, when I just watched it over the weekend.
Right.
Some of the best work, I'm so proud of the work.
Yeah.
You know, the movie wasn't the best movie, but Rob Cohen, who is the director, he made us feel like we were working on the unbelievable, like the best movie in the world.
Yeah.
And we were reading the script and we're like, it sounds like Knight Rider in the sky.
Yep.
But we did it. We worked our butts off.
And it was, you're right, because, you know, Rob was one of those guys, when you go into the screening room, you couldn't wait to go to the screening room to hang out with Rob. And he invited everyone, right? He was one of those directors that invited anyone on the screening room, and he remembered everyone's names.
Unbelievable. Like, I'm the worst at names.
Yeah.
That's why everybody's dude.
Yeah. Yeah. But he remembered everyone's name. He would remember roto artists' names and thank you for working on this shot. And he would say those things. And sometimes he would just, you know, who was the VFX on that one? It was
Joel Hynek,
right. He would just bypass Joel and look at the artist and say, here, this is what I want you to do.
Right.
You know, and Joel's like, okay.
No, it was funny. I just took Mark Rienzo, who was compositor at DD. He worked on Stealth and we saw Independence Day together.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had worked on 2012, and we talked about Rob, and he was in Venice walking down the boardwalk, and there's Rob Cohen a few years ago.
Right.
And knew him. Hey, Mark. Like,
my God, are you serious?
And I'm like, how does that happen? It's so amazing.
Yeah, that is incredible. That's amazing that he did that. Really, really, really good guy. And so I liked it. I liked working on stuff for that reason. Like I said, we were suffering, and there was stuff, and there were some moments that helped that. Help the pain.
Well, I just want to say thank you for, you know, if you felt that way, because that's kind of what we're, at least, you know, the teams that we have when we're working on films is try to buffer as much from the good, you know, let as much of the good stuff in,
yep,
and try to let as much of the bad stuff to stay out. So, but thank you for
absolutely
for remembering those little things.
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't so little, because the first movie I worked on with you, you did that to an extreme, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Day After Tomorrow was a very painful show, and I've noted it before on the podcast that it was like, okay, I noticed. I mean, there's no way you can avoid it. There was chaos going on, right? But you guys,
whole group of chaos.
You guys, specifically the supervisors, right, were amazing at burdening yourself with all the problems and letting us just do our work and say, okay, you're doing a great job. Thanks for helping. Thanks for doing this.
That was really hard, you know, because we had to check ourselves, because it's so easy to fall into like when something's going bad,
right,
and then joke about it and bring it down into walkthroughs or, you know, dailies. And we really needed to look at each other, especially Matthew Butler and myself, and just never try to make light of how crazy it was, and mm-hmm. always keep the focus
right
on the work and do the best work that we possibly can, because that's really the only thing we had control over.
Sure. And it was kind of amazing that you guys did that. And one of the things I remember, because it was my first movie, right? I hadn't done
really
stuff.
That was your first?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Good one. Good on you.
Thank you. So it was my first one, and you know, Andy Waisler, who I've just gotten back in touch with, which has been
great.
Yeah,
me too. He sent me a mail.
Yeah?
Yeah, we should...
We should totally get together.
Yeah.
I want him to be on here. I mentioned him a couple of times because he decided to hire me because he said he was an ex-architect or is back to being an architect now.
Yeah,
And he told me, he's like, I think you understand what it is. It's like, you don't have any credits to your name, but you have a lot of CG experience based in architecture. And I think you know exactly what needs to do and what to get a project done. But I'd never done a film, so there was a lot of missing pieces in my knowledge, right? And one of them was compositing. I rendered everything, and then I put it in Premiere or whatever I was doing. That was what it was. I didn't really know about compositing that much or about treating anything. And so I was on the modeling team for a long time, obviously, you know, on day we're doing all in New York City, because very obvious, you need an architect to make buildings, right? So it was easy for me to do that. Andy was very kind to help me transition into lighting, and we were working on the snowy sequence of New York, which we never actually did in the film, but we were working on it because it got pulled, but that's a different story. But I sort of rendered it. I was experimenting with the new subsurface stuff that we had come up with to create that look of frosty, snowy buildings, and I'd rendered it, and I just rendered RGB, right? I didn't know what else to do. I may have done alpha if I was smart enough, but I just gave it like, I don't know, here it is. And then Andy says, oh, that looks pretty good. It needs some compositing love. It's like, I don't know how to do that. And says, let's see what Brian can do. And you came in and you just like made it sing. And all you had was RGB. You didn't have a specular breakout. You had nothing. And you just made it look really amazing. I said, how does he do that? And it was it was a skill that was the first time I realized, like, oh, compositing is a different thing. And that was the first time it was a realization in my mind how important compositing is. It was really kind of interesting. But how did you get into compositing? How did you get into all this crazy world?
It's funny because I really have College degree to speak of. Tried to go to City College two times for semesters, didn't make it for one reason or another. My car broke down or, you know, got into an accident or whatever, something like that. But really what happened was I was working for a friend who his uncle had a print shop down in Santa Ana.
Yeah.
And I'm like sitting in there and I was actually doing compositing, but I was doing it in a dark room with screens and in a vacuum box and basically layering all these different values of color onto the sheet that you would basically print from.
Manual compositing. Yeah.
And I was like.
So this was for print?
Yeah, for print. I was doing record labels and album covers and just magazines, but it was a dark room and I was there by myself for like 14 hours a day. And I just was starting to get a little crazy. So I looked in the book for UCLA extension classes and I picked a couple. I picked producing music videos.
Yep.
And I picked another one, post-production in film and television. Mm-hmm. And I was just driving from Orange County to UCLA once or twice a week to go to these. And then at the end, producing music videos, there was a tour of this post-production house where we had an editor of a guy named Charlie Randazzo who wasn't doing music videos at the time. And he worked for a place called the Post Group. So we all went for a tour and started walking around and showing this these edit bays with like these switchers that look like you were in a rocket ship.
Yeah.
Or you know, it was just like mind blowing. And everybody was so nice and everything was so cool. And it was just like, whoa. And I'm like, as I'm walking out, there was a guy in the window at the tape library. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how do I get a job here? And he's like, hey, you know, well, here's the guy's name and here's his number and just call him. And I just, for a summer, just started calling.
And you started calling just
in general? Yeah, like once a week, just calling. Until finally, at the end of the summer, I called and was told to come down.
Nice.
I went for an interview with the HR person. And had this great interview showing me everybody. She's like, I love you. You're going to get this job. I'm like, great. And then she's like, so what college did you graduate from? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't have a college degree. Well, she went, oh, because like entry level position, you need to at least have a college degree to work in the tape library. And I'm like, really? And she's like, okay, wait, hold on. Let me see what I can do. And she's looking in the list. She's like, dishwasher, because they had their own kitchen. Like, she's like, no, I won't do that to you. And then she's like, okay, nighttime receptionist, would you be willing to work nights and answer the phone? And I'm like, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to do that.
Sure. And How old were you?
I was like 21.
Okay.
21?
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of had graduated, bummed around doing construction, and then figured I needed to do something.
Yeah.
But yeah, so just nighttime and there was this machine room in the back and it was all these people. And I just went behind in the back at night or during the day and I just learned. I just talked to people. And then I moved from that to building maintenance, which is basically changing light bulbs.
Right.
You know, if there was leaks in the roof, I would fix the leaks and clean the edit bays. But that gave me full access to the facility.
Now, don't you think a lot of people, you know, obviously nighttime shift work seems horrible because you have to work nights, but it's actually a huge opportunity because it's not so busy and so it's plenty of opportunity to learn, right?
Oh, yeah. And I took full advantage. And, and you know, long story short, I just pissed enough people off where I was back there editing my brother's wedding video in the same edit bay that, you know, they just rendered, just did. George Harrison video, you know, stuff like that. And I was there on a Sunday and I didn't know how to like really one-inch machines. I knew how to do the three-quarters because you just stick it in and hit play. But the one-inch machines, you had to, you know,
feed the loop,
feed it. Right. And I had a one-inch machine up where I had my Super 8 camera, which I bought, which I shot my brother's wedding on, mm-hmm. and had one of the girls in Telecine transfer it for me. And I was basically editing a film project, but it was my brother's wedding.
Right.
And
but you learned all the steps.
Yeah. And so the one inch got flown off because I was rewinding it too fast, and the person in the back room like saw me working in there and then basically banned me from working in the machine room, because I didn't do the proper step. I didn't go to the machine room, learn how to put the tapes up properly, right. how to get everything working from the back before you can sit in the editor chair.
Right.
And, you know, at first I was like really pissed off, but yeah. I kind of understood. And so I wasn't able to learn, so I took another job at night. Now mm-hmm. that I was working day, I went and I took a job at night doing dubs, a place called Dubs Inc. in Burbank.
Okay.
And we were just make copies of, you know, cartoons or Soul Train. We were doing Soul Train so that they can air it across, you know, the world, so to speak. I did that for 3 months until I couldn't do it because I wasn't getting enough sleep.
Right.
But I did have somebody back at the post group who was knew that I was taking these extra steps. And I took the test, and everybody was blown away because there was 3 months I was not learning or doing anything.
Right.
And here I took the tape op test, but I've been working all this whole time.
Right.
And I took it, and then, yeah. And they said, how'd you do that? And I said, I did this.
I learned.
And they were blown away, and you know, and then I've always just done that, just kept pushing and learning, and surrounding myself with the most talented people that I possibly can.
Yeah,
and you know, it rubs off because you know how, and I think that's, you know, where I am now is I've worked with these talented people, I've seen how they've reacted, mm-hmm. or worked with other people, and how professional and how good.
Yes.
And how respectful. And because if there was somebody I didn't like or didn't think was very respectful, mm-hmm. I chose not to learn from them.
Yeah.
There was nothing I was going to get from somebody.
Yeah, you're not going to gain anything.
Yeah. So I never put myself in a position where I was learning bad. I was learning anything that I didn't feel that was what I felt in my heart that was what I needed to learn. So from the post group, met a bunch of people, friends, still friends now. Was there 6 years. Went to a place called Digital Magic, which was kind
I know that
an offshoot.
Yep.
Rich Thorne, who was running Post Group, opened his own place. We were doing Star Trek, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, where I met Rob Legato and a lot of the people that that worked on that show, which then brought me to Digital Domain.
Right.
And that's a story in itself. I don't know if we have enough time, but there was a woman called Veronica Murdoch, who I worked with at Digital Magic, and she was hired by Scott Ross right after True Lies.
Okay.
And they were just starting up. They were doing some work on Godzilla back then. They were going to do a Godzilla movie.
Okay.
And they were also starting up on Apollo 13.
Right.
But I said, I would love to work there. And she's like, okay, let me get here a few months. Let me suss it out. And she unfortunately had the job of kind of letting some people go at the end of True Lies. Uh-huh. And so people were asking for shots so they can put on their reel. Mm-hmm. And I was editing at that time. So she said, why don't you come in? And if you're going to, why don't you cut demo reels for some of the people that are leaving?
Right. Because back then it was not easy to do a demo reel. Right?
No.
Yeah.
So I literally did that on my own again for another 3 months at night. Every day I would work or do it a day because I work nights at Digital Magic, and I would cut reels and, you know, demo reels.
Right.
And then
what was a demo reel like back then? It was basically just a bunch of shots that you'd work on.
Yeah, we would select music, you know, one track, and then I would just sit there and cut and make it look cool.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. And so that's what you did for them to help them out, right? And so,
yeah.
And then how did you actually get to work on Apollo 13?
Well, I was people had recognized my face, and I went to
the— And you were doing this at Digital Domain?
At Digital Domain.
Oh, because the material was there.
Yeah, and went to the Halloween party. The first one I went to, I think it was the vampire party. And just, I was like, I want to work here, and I want this to happen. And sure enough, in January, this was October, finally January, I got a call and from Veronica. She's like, nighttime, you know, Flame/Flint. And I'm like, well, I don't know Flame/Flint. And she's like, well, nobody does because it's kind of new. And we're going to send our compositors from DD to a class just down the street at Discrete Logic. And I'm sending you with them. I wasn't even— And I wasn't even there yet. But I sat in the back, you know, quiet, and I just took notes. And sure enough, I just landed there one night. Kind of under the radar, which was the big problem, because at the time there was Price Pethel, who was running the 2D department, and loved the man and has the best eye, and a southern man with a lot of pride. And he, because he didn't hire me, and I kind of snuck through the back, the back road, so to speak, he really wasn't giving me the time of day. So I really had to prove myself. That I belong there. And it was some hard times because, you know when somebody is sitting next to somebody and like teaching them the wisdom of the world and how to composite. And I'm just like, my ear is as close as I can be trying to listen, because I knew I was not going to get necessarily that attention at the time. Because things did turn around on Apollo 13. I did do a shot where the LEM was in outer space, and they needed the thrusters, the look of the thrusters for the first time. And I remember all I had was thrusters rendered locked off at a couple different angles. And I had a—
This is a practical effect.
No, it was CG.
Oh, it was a CG.
CG. So they rendered it at a couple different angles, looking towards camera, looking, and then 45 degrees away, and one in the middle. And basically, I just hand tracked and then dissolved between, depending on the motion of the LEM. And then I had to figure out how to color correct and then reveal and do, you know. So basically, they gave me a shot. They came in the next day, and my camphor, who is the compositing soup, I was still there from the night before. And he's like, okay, Brian, show me what you got. We got Ron Howard coming in. He's been asking about these thrusters. And I'm like, okay, this is what I got. And he goes, He goes, I'll be right back. And then next thing I know, Rob Legato comes over. And Mike's like, Rob, I think you should see this. I think we got something we could show Ron. And Rob looks at it. He goes, And then they go away, and then next time they come back, it's with Ron Howard and Rob LeBeau.
So this is your first night, first shot. So now you're in a bay, and then Ron Howard
I'm just sitting there, and Rob goes, hey, Ron, so those thrusters you've been asking about over here, you know, I got them for you. And then sure enough, I play them, and Ron's like, yeah, that's it. So that kind of got me in. That was, and they called me Thruster Boy. That was my nickname.
High five, man.
Before OT, but so that happened, and then the show finished, and it was— they were thinking about hiring some of the people on, and then Price Pethel came to me and took me in the office, and he goes, "I know I was— I kind of was riding hard on you," and he goes, "But you know, you have to know I didn't hire you, so it was like I didn't know if you just— how you did stuff, you blurred edges and wrote it, you know, here, like he was teaching, we have to keep the photographic edge." And I was all about that. I was like, yeah, let's do that. That's so cool. It's— we're making films and it's all photography. Yeah, let's do it. And he, you know, he gave me one of the best compliments after that, where he basically said, I wish I had hired you. And
it's awesome.
And I think that that's what stuck with me. I think from that point on, where it was so important, like, I really love this industry. I really love what we do. I'm passionate. And I've even, you know, I've been kind of told, like push kind of hard. And I think, you know, I've learned to back off, because I just want things to be, you know, cool.
I don't know if you push hard. I think you push, you see potential in people. And then you show them, it's like, I know you can do this. I know you can do that. And that's the pushing part, because some people feel like they're unsure about themselves, but you've You said, no, I have complete confidence in the fact that you're going to be able to do this.
And absolutely.
Like, I don't know if I can do this. It's like, no, I know you can, but you're going to do it.
Yeah.
And so that's the pushing part. It's not like, come on.
Yeah, no, it's, well, it is because I get riled up. I mean, I'm kind of passionate, and I'm known for, you know, walking down, going, woo, put my hands up.
Yeah.
Help me, help you, help me, help you.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, you're a very, very passionate person, and you make I don't know. I've always felt really great working with you. So it was a little bit sad for me when I went back to DD to find out that you weren't there anymore. But I know you've done amazing jobs over at Scanline, which we'll get to because I obviously want to get to.
Yes, Scanline.
Awesome stuff you've been doing over
pretty
there.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's an incredible place. But so that was your first big thing, right? And then I want to find out a little bit. When I knew you, you were very, very close friends with Matthew Butler.
Oh, yeah, still am.
So obviously you still are. And he's an incredible person. But I always saw you two as like this dynamic duo of some kind, right? You always backed each other up.
Well,
and you worked.
Yeah, I mean, what comes down is Matthew is MIT – like mathematician genius. I mean, he is.
Yeah.
Like, what is in
that's
his
the best
head?
Thing about DD, isn't it? It's like the.
Yeah, I mean, and here I am. I'm literally off the streets, a kid from Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, and a completely 180 degree different world where actually math was not my strong point.
Sure.
I think I won an essay when I was in ninth grade. You know, contest where my essay went into a time capsule at my school up here. But that was as creative or as
academic.
I got. Yeah. But I think what it was is we were a good team because I was very grounded in where he was like, no, it has to work. And, you know, it has to be like this because it's mathematically correct.
Right.
And I would go, look, I would turn a dial and go, that's not mathematically correct, but it's looked better. And he's like, oh, yes, it looks marvelous.
Yep.
And that was the way of kind of reining each other in.
Yeah. No, it was a perfect combination.
So that, the things that I was like, why can't it do that? And he's like, physically. And I'm like, well, we're making a film.
Right.
Wouldn't it be cool? And he's like, Brian, yes, it would be cool, but physically it's not correct. And then we would find a way to tell the story where we both got what we wanted.
I just to give people an idea of Matthew, I was sitting there it was on day, I think, actually, and there was some argument that happened in the screening room. And I'm the new guy. I've never worked on a film. This is all a brand new experience. So even with all the chaos going on, I'm just like my eyes were wide open as to how interesting this was. And the fact also that there was here is an industry that celebrates your talent and not necessarily your aptitudes, right?
Right.
So Matthew Butler's got a PhD in aeronautics,
yes.
Right? So he's like pretty much a rocket scientist, right? And then you're a guy who basically, like you said, a kid from the streets of Brooklyn that are sitting there as partners.
Right.
And that is only in this industry does that happen. I did a podcast with Brandon Davis also.
Yeah, Brandon.
Another guy, brilliant person, you know, doesn't have a college degree. Now he's actually trying to get his college degree, which is kind of fun.
But he's working hard.
He's working really hard. Yeah, fighting cancer and going to college.
Amazing.
That's the thing I think I celebrate about this industry. It's like, you are talented and therefore it doesn't matter. Like, that talent will come from whatever. It doesn't have to have come from a formalized education, which I think is really cool.
It's a lot of osmosis. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, places like DDILM, RNH, you know, these places that have been around for a while and you work there. I mean, that's one of the things, you know, I was there for 14 years, you know, Matthew's still there. There's Doug Robel. He's the co-founder of digital domain by now with all the years he's been, but it's
by far the most senior.
Yeah. But just by working with these people over a period of time, everybody kind of gets out of each other the best from each other, you know?
Sure.
It's very, I mean, I walked away with that with so much from so many different people.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, even now, but I think because our industry is structured in a way where there's not that much longevity, and I think it's really important if you really want to make make an impact in what we do, for me personally, the way it's worked is by working with a lot of the same people for a while,
yeah,
and just really understanding that. I mean, and what came to fruition or climax for me was working with Clint Eastwood.
Mm. And his, on Flags of Our Fathers.
Flags of Our Fathers with his group at Mel Paso. And mm-hmm. that's how they run. They work with the same people
yep.
over and over again, as much as they possibly can.
The communication is so much better.
Everybody knows what yep. What Clint wants, what they're doing. Everybody has direction. Everybody is moving forward. And even if the direction is not there, they know at the very least when you show up, even if you don't know what to do, you better figure it out because Clint wants the camera set up and at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you don't know what the shot is, then get there at 9 and start talking to people and you figure it out because right. at 9:30 we're shooting.
Right. Yep.
yeah. And I just thought that that was the perfect Hollywood. Like if I had my druthers and if I could make it so number one
yeah.
and I would want kind of a snapshot of that the way that works and, you know, have a company or work for a company or be a part of something like that because it was no bullshit. It yep. was filmmaking. It was good. It was bad. It was what it was because everybody respected each other and went forth and put out their best effort.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got, a really good product, but
yeah.
but at the end, you know, it is what it is. That's why I keep telling everybody who I work for. I remember being in the screening room, DD, and even at Scanline. It's like the only control we have is doing the best work we can.
Yep.
You know, the studio, they're going to have their thing. The director, everybody's going. There's going to be wars waged over this film, but if our stuff is tight and serves the purpose of the story,
mm-hmm.
then we're doing our job. Whatever happens after that, and even critics, the movie could be great, but critics could, for some reason, not like one person or something sure. about it, and you're going to get something negative. But I've never, knock on wood, looked at a review where they took the visual effects to a place, where a dark place where I would crawl up in the corner in a fetal position.
Right.
Go, what am I doing?
Well, I think, to be honest, there's something very specific about production and post-production where we all have to, we're forced to work on a team. Here, I think you need another pour here.
Okay. Well, right, thank you, sir.
So in this, in the industry, I mean, basically you have to work as a team. There's no choice. So when egos get in the way, they don't work. And so you kind of have to like, that gets put down very quickly. It's like, I'm the best, whatever. And it's like, yeah, whatever. It's so much more rewarding to work as a team than an individual in this industry because you kind of have to.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the thing is like people feel rewarded by the team aspect and they get really excited.
Exactly. And even to this day, working at Scanline, one of the big things for me is not just pride in, the artistic that we're putting on the screen, but it's very important for me and Scanline as mm-hmm. as a team or as a company that when we work on a show with production, that the production at the end, they go that you guys were the best.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed working with you. You guys were on top of stuff. And again, the visuals are, they're here or there, but it's that day-to-day that how we were able to help them when they needed help, how they were able to help us when we needed sure. help. And I think that, to me, is the filmmaking aspect of it. It's the groups. It's everybody working together to somehow get through this maze
yeah.
because it can get pretty foggy and pretty crazy
yeah.
and put a lot of hours in driving in a big fog bank just to yeah. find out that you're right where you started from.
Mm-hmm. yeah. But I also think it's, not only is it good practice and rewarding because you feel good about yourself in the end, but it's also just good business. they're going to come back to you, right?
Yeah. I mean, business is funny because you can do that. And I mean, I look at it as it is good business, but it's the business that I like to be in.
Right.
Not everybody wants to be in that type of business. They'll be in the business. And even if you do your best, and there's always other factors why you're not working with them again, you know, either be budget or
sure.
time or we're not available. You know what right. I mean? So there's always a factor in there. And for me, I would love, you know, that repeatability, you know, much like the Clint Eastwood way of doing it.
What is, okay, so everyone who's ever worked on the Clint Eastwood film, specifically, I know a lot of people that worked on the Flags of Our Fathers stuff, they always have one of their favorite Clint Eastwood stories. Do you have one of your favorite Clint Eastwood stories?
Well, I have three.
Okay.
So
you can pick your favorite, you can tell all three, I don't care.
So the first one, my favorite Clint Eastwood story was, we were working with Michael Owens, who was his longtime collaborator on yep. visual effects. And we had been working on shots and really not been showing Clint at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically had our first 50 shots up for final.
Sure.
Clint comes over with his producer and editor to our screening room. And Michael's like, okay, Clint, we're going to show you these shots. I'm just going to run them. And then, you know, wherever you feel like you want to stop. We'll go through it. And it was in the morning. So he was like, do you have a cupcake or a brownie or something? And we had a bran raisin.
Right.
And he's like, oh, that's great. So he's sitting there in the front row.
Mm-hmm.
Not the front row, actually a couple rows back.
Oh, interesting.
He didn't want to be in the front row.
Interesting.
And he's eating his raisin bran, and he's going and he's watching, and the whole thing played,
mm-hmm.
and we stopped, and he's like, well, play it again. So we played all 50 shots, mm-hmm. and it stopped, and he's like, there was that one shot. And we were like, okay. And
you had 50 shots,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And we started going through.
And was it on film or?
It was on film.
Okay.
And we started going through and he's like, you know, where the head blows off. And so we find it, mm-hmm. we get it, and we start looping it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, what's wrong, Clint? He's like, sure would be great if we had some more smoke in the back, in the background. Uh-huh. And we're all like looking at each other and we're like, yeah, we can do that.
Right.
And he's like, takes a sip of coffee. Okay. And then we're like, well, is there anything else? I mean, and he's like, nope, all looks good. So we basically got 49 out of 50 finals just that it looped and he was off and on his way and,
yeah.
you know, said, thank you very much. Really enjoyed
it. So
you
had one comment out of 50 shots, which was yeah. smoke, a little more smoke.
It was just, and you know, to...
Well, he's so pragmatic.
Yes, but to Michael Owen's credit too, who knows how to get a shot.
He made sure it was the right presented.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. So I learned a lot from Michael in those situations. And then mm-hmm. the next time we were, this was a couple films after, it was Hereafter.
Oh, right.
Which I worked with at Scanline.
Yeah.
And we were up in this hotel room in Kaanapali in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And we were scanning this courtyard of the Sheraton mm-hmm. with the LiDAR. And then Rob Lorenz, his producer, and Clint walk in. And we have a LiDAR guy. He was sitting there, you know, watching, making sure. And he's saying, don't move because... It was an older building. He didn't want it to move. And, you know, the door opens up and there's Rob and Clint and and the whole place is shaking a little mm-hmm. bit. And he gets up and he's like, what are you guys doing? I told you not to move. And there's Clint and Rob going, look at him going, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I'm like, oh, Clint, this is Robert, our LiDAR scanner. and he was like, oh, it shook his hands and everything was fine. He just didn't realize.
Right.
And I'm just standing there. And then Rob Lorenz looks over at Clint and he goes, oh, and Clint, you remember Brian? He's like, oh, yeah, Brian, it's lucky it wasn't you walking on here or else the whole building would have shook. And I'm like, thank you.
You're kind of a big guy.
And then about a week later, we're on the streets in Lahaina Mm-hmm. And everybody, we're filming and everybody's busy, and I'm sitting there with my camera and I'm ready to take pictures. And it was literally just Clint and myself.
Yep.
And a few people running around. He was like, "Hey, Brian." And I didn't realize he was talking to me. I was right. Looking around. I thought it was another Brian.
Right.
He's like, "Brian." And I'm like, and I wasn't looking at him. And he went, "Brian, the camera you have,
yeah,
does it have film in it?" And I looked at him and realized, I'm like, "No, Clint, this is a digital camera. We don't have film anymore." And he's like, "Oh, well, your lens cap is on." And we both just lost it. I was laughing. I thought it was so funny. But those are my...
Oh, that's awesome. Well, Clint, I've always heard, I mean, a lot of people have told these stories about how amazingly efficient he is, right? And I've got a friend of mine who's worked on set with him. Actually, was on, I believe it was on Flags of Our Fathers. He's a friend of mine who works as he's a dolly grip, right? And so he pulled camera for Clint for a long time. But he was saying it's like, you know, he shows up, they shoot, and they're wrapped by three because he's like, he's Mr. First Take in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he wants.
No, it almost to, for us, it was a shock. On Flags of Our Fathers, we're in a beach in Iceland. And we had all these shots, and it's a very smooth beach, black mm-hmm. sand.
Yep.
And we needed to put tracking markers. So we came up with this idea where we'd take these 4x4s and put these big orange marine buoys on top, on the top part of the beach. Mm-hmm. So at least we had something
to see, right?
We could track and see. And we weren't supposed to get to the top of the berm because it was like the invasion. We had 500 extras, all this right. marine craft coming in, and till after lunch.
Right.
And it was before lunch, all of a sudden they start ripping the poles out and start and we're like freaking out. We're like, what's going on? We need those poles there. They're like, we're going on the berm now. And we're like, what? It's only like 10:30
right.
in the morning. What happened to the 500 Marines getting from the water? We're right. done with that. We're going up the berm. So they ripped everything out. And we're like freaking out, going, oh, my God. And like he was doing like passes. Like we had originally said, oh, well, you know, maybe we'll do a take without like the explosion. And then we'll sure. do a take with the explosion. So we had a difference of sorts. And Michael Holmes is like laughing. He was like, guys, there is no, it's like sometimes he'll take the rehearsal. You know, there's no way you're going to get what you want unless you specifically, like, we need
it's
to get
schedule.
This. Yeah. And so anyway, they break for lunch. We're all at our table in the tent, like all like going, what are we going to do? We just got totally sideswiped, and Rob Lorenz comes over and he goes, welcome to the Clint Eastwood movie.
Yep.
And he goes, guys, just roll with it. This is Clint is moving through this stuff. He likes what he's seeing, mm-hmm. you know, just figure out a way to do it so that we're not in everybody's way. And we're not slowing things down.
Right.
And from that point on, we were totally on board.
Yep.
And knew that sometimes we had to do stuff the night before or stay late just to get, because we were moving on from set to set. Mm-hmm. So as far as scanning or, taking pictures, it was really like we were like 24 hours, right. like completely always thinking, like so that it was not, we were not in the way of the process.
Sure.
Cause that's in, and like, for example, hereafter, I mean, we had a whole sequence, 7-minute sequence of a tsunami coming in, and they shot that. And, we had to come up with a way of getting all the material and information so that we can recreate everything. And he just shot it as if there was a wave coming down. Like nothing stopped him from doing what he was doing. And he can imagine what it looked like. And he was just, really did his homework.
Yeah. It's funny because I was looking at it. I was looking at a couple of things today. I was like, oh, let's see what Brian's been up to. Cause I was like, I'm going to talk to him today. I'm going to check it out. And I noticed that, like, you know, hereafter you were nominated for an Oscar for that one, right?
Yeah,
it was good. And you were nominated for an Oscar for Winter Soldier as well.
Right? Love that movie, yeah.
Great movie.
Great
I
team.
I really love
Marvel. Really, they have their shit together.
I think the first Captain America is like, okay. And then after Winter Soldier, I'm like, I think he's my new favorite character in a weird way, although it's very interesting. Like, I think this battle between those two characters is really fascinating. But what I think is hilarious about it is that you lost both of those Oscars to two Christopher Nolan movies.
Oh, I see. This is part of the garage where you take the tools out and stick them in and turn.
I'm just saying.
Which, what is this? This is not a garage,
example. No. But Chris Nolan, like, it was in, you lost to Inception and yourself. By the way, those are great movies to lose to, so you shouldn't necessarily feel awful about it.
Believe me, again, it all comes down to, like, you have no, there's no way you can plan on anything.
Right.
You just do your best. And those couple times, the best brought us to a level and, you know, just got us to a place. And you have no idea what's happening, and things change like that. And like I said, you just keep doing the best and don't expect anything from it, because that's when you start, like, your head starts doing tricks on you.
There's no question.
You
about
know,
that.
You can't, like, start thinking about, oh, well, but what can I do better next time? And
I don't think that's
like, no, because it's not about going there.
Right.
It's about getting through and telling the story and making sure everybody comes out alive.
Right. Well, I mean, nonetheless, you're still an Academy member at this point, right?
Yeah, no. That's all. That's
all good.
Great.
I love it. I love those movies. And I want to say I love Winter Soldier. Obviously, like you said, it was a great movie. But I remember specifically on Hereafter, I'd never seen the movie before, and I was invited. I was a VES member at the time, and I was invited to be one of the judges to go through the nominations for the VES Awards.
Yeah.
You know that thing that they do. So it's over at Photocam, and it was great. And somehow I was put on the panel that was about was one of the big ones. And Hereafter, the shot of the whole tsunami sequence came up, and the breakdown and all of that stuff. And I was like, nothing I had seen at that time had ever even come close to that quality of work. And I was just blown away. To be honest, if you were only going to take one section of a movie, like a sequence,
right,
and give that to the Oscars, there's no question to me that Hereafter should have won for that. I think that
it's
Winter
much
Soldier,
like the bear sequence.
Yes, the bear sequence.
Yes.
Exactly. It's like that thing was one of the most incredible, heart-wrenching, incredible, painful, so well done, so beautifully composite, so incredible. You felt every moment of that. And, of course, that's the point of it, right? That the point of it is to make you feel that way. Props to Clint Eastwood for telling that story. But so well executed.
Well, side story, M. Night Shyamalan. He came in a couple years ago to Scanline, wanted to see our reel. We showed him the Hereafter reel, and he actually had that film. He was going to do that film before Clint.
Oh, really?
But he could not come up with a way to do that opening sequence. It befuddled him, like how to get it to work, and, you know, all the things that you said.
Right.
There was something about that he couldn't make happen.
Right.
And he kind of passed on it. Mm-hmm. And when he saw it and he saw how he did it, it he was like, wow. You guys, like, he struggled a long time to figure out how to do something like that, but still have the, you know, emotional impact. So it wasn't, you know, the CG wave coming through and making it a platform, where it was more like it was more about the characters and less about what was the CG wave, for example.
Sure. Well, let's get into Scanline a little bit, because I want to make sure we cover what you did at Scanline and how that's been. Because how long have you been there? You've been there a while now, right?
Just turned 7 years in
7 years.
June, yeah.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good.
This is a pretty great place. Danny, Stefan, obviously great people. I'm sure you're very close friends with them. Mm-hmm. How's that? Tell me a little bit about Scanline. I want people to, if you're going to go out there and you're going to say, it's like, all right, there's some people want to know more about Scanline. What would you, how would you how would you, what's the biggest thing, the strengths, the amazing things, the people, or what's strong about that?
Well, I think for me was, you know, working at DD and working with all these amazing people for, you know, 14 years, mm-hmm. and at a point where I knew it was time for me to go. Mm-hmm. There was new owners. There was just a lot of politics that I want to make movies. I want to have fun.
Sure.
Make visual effects, and there was just so much going on.
I don't think you need an excuse to make a reason why you wanted to move.
But
on.
It, for me, it was very hard.
Sure.
It was a hard thing. But and I'm like,
yeah, because you've been there 14 years.
Yeah. So where do I go? Where do I go? You know, how do I make an impact?
Sure.
Because I didn't want to be working for a bigger company where eventually would fall into the same type of scenario of politics and that type of thing. So. I ran into Danny and Stefan, and they said, come on over to Scanline when I was done with my project over at DD. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I finished G.I. Joe, mm-hmm.
I got
a call from Joe Mendias, uh-huh. almost 3 months to the day. So they were, you know, on point, went over there. They showed me their reel, talked with them, saw their facility in Culver, and I talked to Stefan, who I had talked to, but really, you know, hadn't gone in depth. And we sat there and we really had some really great discussions mm-hmm. about, you know, what is it that excites us and what are we passionate about?
Sure.
And I think it was those discussions and also the fact that what they had been doing with the water. Coming from DD was very effects savvy and some amazing effects.
Yep.
You know, where does somebody like Brian go to, you know, not feel like he's taking a step back? And there was a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was a lot of good technology at Scanline.
The technology at Scanline is incredible. Incredible and really beautiful, beautiful work that hones it. And sorry to say, I mean, I don't want, but when I look at a shot, I'm like, that's a Scanline shot. I can tell. You can tell, right? There's something about the left, definitely heavy on the, especially if there's effects or fluids or anything like that. Obviously, there's something about flow line that makes it very, that has an incredibly solid look. Like, nothing looks as good as that in a lot of cases. But I love that what they do is like they've got a look and they've got things and there's something that's really fantastic about it. So I can tell.
It's definitely something that they've gravitated and gotten better over and over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But really it just came to the conversation. It was like basically what Stefan said is, hey, we got this thing going. We're on a train. We don't know where the train's taking us.
Yep.
But do you want to get on this train?
Yeah.
And, you know, take a ride with us. And I was like, you know, I can dig that. That's cool.
Yep.
Because there was a lot of people and not at the time, you know, DreamWorks was open and there was a lot of other facilities. And you almost saw a lot of people who were coming from film school going directly to a DreamWorks, which was a great place. You know, obviously, timetables, you're working, waiting, you know, working on a show for 3 years.
Sure.
You know, you're working 9 to 5. Not necessarily the film industry that you and I know of. And to me, it felt almost like retirement because I don't know.
Going out to pasture.
I've never gone to happy hour in the last 14 years unless it was a walkthrough.
Right. Yep.
I remember
doing a situation where we were going out to get a coffee break at 6 p.m., right? So I think it was with Charles Abouad. I don't know if you remember Charles.
Yeah,
but I was sitting with Charles and we're walking down Main Street. It's like, let's take a coffee break. Because we knew we still had another 3 or 4 hours of work, right? And 6 p.m.
And not to say that.
And the people are at the bar having drinks and like, what's going on? It's like, oh, they're finishing their day. We're just trying to get coffee to keep going.
Yeah. And not to take anything away, but that wasn't me. I wasn't ready for that. I felt like I still had, you know, a lot of effort to give forth.
Yeah.
So I joined Scanline, and first I came on to help them on 2012. There were still 10 weeks left.
Was that your second Roland Emmerich movie?
That was the second one. And and at the time, they really didn't – they had just started using Nuke. Yeah. And they were hiring their 2D department, or their, you know, was still waiting, you know, trying to get some people to, you know, write code and kind of make it work in the pipeline. And it was kind of working. And I came on at a good time where they had a supervisor already. Uh-huh. And you know, Stefan was like, no, I want you, no, you should take over. And I'm like, no.
Oh, really?
I'm like, no. I'm like, he's the supervisor. I'm gonna help. Uh-huh. And that's all I did. I just was in the background and, you know, did took shots and basically did look frames and started to come up with a look of sequence and, you know, and just try to help. And then the big thing was the QC process. Because a smaller company didn't really understand the QC process, which was like beaten into us at Digital Domain.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
gauntlet.
The gauntlet. And which to this day, it's so important. You know, I keep telling all these compositors and new compositing supervisors how important it is, if at the very least we have to deliver something that's technically sound, you know, the edges of the mat, whatever it is, can't be any errors. You know, we have to make sure the grain is good, because the end of the day, it's not really what's the picture is, it's the quality of that picture on a technical standpoint. Because what we don't want to do is deliver it to the production and then it goes through
Telecine,
whatever, and the DI, and then all of a sudden they're making the reels, and they're like, "Oh yeah, there's a mat line." You know, you don't want to be that guy, or that facility. and if there's any problems in the DI or what have you, you don't want to be. At the very least, that's what our job. So, I brought that to the table, and it really, I thought, you know, helped.
It's probably a little bit rough on the compositors, like you got a really quality,
you know, controller. But. You know, you give the notes and you help out, and you if they're busy doing something, then I'd sit there and
But the company's now a big company. This is not is not the small company that you entered into.
No, we've kind of grown. I think not last year, a year and a half ago, we were at our biggest, and we were doing over almost 2,000 shots a year, which is which was too much, I think. And since then, we've taken on. Gone back a little bit and just make sure that we're not just filling seats and just trying to keep up with the Joneses, because right now Vancouver is a hot spot and there's, you know, facilities growing and you know, wanting to hire more people, and it's just a madhouse. So the last year, what we decided as a company, which was a great decision by Stefan and Danny, was just to take on, like, have our core group of people, the people who wanted to be there, you know, and all the people who wanted to go off and work at the other companies because there was opportunity, you know, let all that happen, because it's going to happen anyway, but let it happen before we get into the middle of a show. And we only took on the work that fit our core group of people, and it worked out great.
Good.
And we had a great time on Independence Day. The year before on San Andreas, it was one of the most technically hard shows.
I love that movie.
It was so hard. And
it was weird because that I was looking at the trailer style movie. It's like, okay, whatever. And then I saw the movie. It's like, you know what? That was a good movie. Looked fantastic.
It really moved. It was a good a good show. Proud of the work. At the time for us, it was difficult. There was a lot of shows that ran long, or for example, Fast and Furious, they had to take a break because of Paul Walker, and so like the perfect scenario kind of got broken. So it was a rough finish, so to speak, because of just resources being as perfectly planned as they were.
Sure.
You know, you throw those wrenches in and things get a little crazy. So we worked it out the best we could. But last year on Independence Day, it was ran very smoothly. And again, you know, working with Roland and being one of the first facilities on, And the type of work that we were doing was definitely
for Independence Day
in our wheelhouse. Yeah,
yeah.
And a lot. We learned a lot on San Andreas, and it. I mean, our facility is set up to do the hard shots.
Yes,
that is what the facility is set up to do. And
you got something we can't do? We'll do it.
I mean, there was. Mohsin Mousavi, who is the VFX supervisor in Vancouver, who you should have on the show because he knows.
Yeah, well. No, he actually has been on V-Ray Days. He's presented for us. Yeah. He's a great guy.
So he had a interview the other last week, and one of the effects we needed to do was recreate the kind of the cloud tank simulation of as the ship was coming into our atmosphere, like they did in the first Independence Day. So we needed to recreate that, and it was like so far and above like what we've had to do ever before.
Sure.
So the way he put it was we were running sims once we kind of got the basic look down that we would run sims, and the sims would basically run overnight and take up 10 terabytes.
Each sim.
And we would kick maybe 5 or 6 off.
Wow.
And then come back in the morning and go, what worked, you know, by changing some parameters,
right.
Which worked, which broke, you know, what new bugs did we find? But it was important in order to be able to do that. And Scanline's like the only place where you can like do that. And
I'm going to put this in a little perspective in terms of you and I. And
did I say, I said 10 terabytes.
Yeah.
Did I say 10 terabytes?
Yes.
Okay.
So 10 terabytes per sim.
Yeah.
And you kicked off 5 a night to just try different things, right?
Yeah.
And that's the amount of data you require to do a sim.
Yeah.
Now let's put that in perspective back to the first movie we worked on, which is Day After Tomorrow. We did all of that on 2 terabytes.
Yeah.
Because that's how much disk space we had available back then. So that's crazy town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
the sims are, I mean, you guys are definitely well known for your sims and definitely well known for your fluids and making it work. Art directing that, how does that work?
Well, we had Ryo Saraguchi.
Yeah, I know Ryo.
Yeah, he was on our team, and he started working with trying to match the original, and you know he was very successful with the basic look. Then we needed to figure out how to actually do it and run it through our pipeline.
Sure.
And between him and Stefan, in a 2-week period, they basically went and just pounded our render farm, and just we had 6 shots that Roland, only 2 actually made it in the film, but we simmed 6 shots, presented it to him just so that he could wrap his head around the storytelling of the ship coming in and doing what it does. And it was just some throwaway work, but it was one of those things that was needed to happen.
Right.
And Stefan, you know, he's incredible because he like I said, the reason that we got together and because Steph Scanline is such a cool place for me to work and a lot of people, is he's very passionate and he wants to do the best, and he writes the code, he renders the shots, you know, he's there fixing bugs, you know. And I appreciate
that's
that.
Gotta be fascinating. Stefan is an interesting character because here he is. He's running a company. He owns the company. He's doing the business. He's getting the work. He's writing the code. He's doing shots. Like,
but doing it like not in like he's not doing shots for the sake of getting a shot out.
No, just no, to this test
is
his code.
This is the development stage and coming up with a look and then designing the software so that it is as good as it possibly can be throughout the rest of the.
Which is amazing. This is the fact that that happens, that someone in that level is doing that. I would love to have Stefan on here and bang his brain. I've met him several times. Obviously, I know him pretty well. But it's like that balance of being someone that's running a business, doing this, doing that, and also coding is incredible.
Well, he has some some help.
Sure,
with
of course
the
it
development,
does.
But
he's got a vision, though.
Totally has a vision, and one of the great things when it comes to you know, client services, for example, I remember, you know, at DD, you know, we would update software or we'd write software to help with the pipeline. And basically every time you started a show, everybody agreed that this was the version of the software we were going to stick with. Yep. This was the version of race. This was the, you know, we had to lock things down in order for the show to work.
Right.
Like, because it was so many things. You couldn't just be willy-nilly changing things.
Sure.
And Stefan, like, to his credit, he part of the sell is the software will not be the same from when we started. It will evolve so that, you know, from beginning to the end,
yep.
we're constantly creating imagery that is to your liking, you know.
Sure.
And if it takes reworking and, you know, writing new code or whatever it takes, that's what it takes. It's not, we're locking this down and you kind of will figure it out how to do it.
No.
I don't think anyone does that anymore.
Be honest, and he has the right attitude. Obviously, he does. But you're right. There was a lot of like, we're locking down on this version of Maya. We're locking down on this version of Nuke or whatever. This is the version you're using. That doesn't happen as much anymore, to some extent.
Yeah, and you know, and because still, from a business standpoint, you have to obviously be aware. And it's not, again, it's not this free willy where, you know, just writing something or changing something is not necessarily going to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of it is going, you know, what is it that you don't like about it and how can we change it? Writing new code is not necessarily the way to go. It's like, what can we do to make this to look the way you want it to look and not always, you know, a lot of times it's just listening to really what is it going to make the shot work in the cut?
Right.
You know, and a lot of times that's where you have to go immediately before it becomes, you know, because you get changes all the time from some executive here or some producer here.
Yeah.
You can't be chasing your tail. You have to really get down to, and a lot of that needs to come at the beginning when it's like, okay, we haven't done that before. So we know there's going to be a ramp up of getting to where we need to go. But once we feel we're there, we are confident and we push and we go, okay, now what is it that we need to do for the shot? And, you know, there's not going to be a miracle unless, you know, you tell us what it is that's going to, you know, make it work. And I think that's really the filmmaking side and not necessarily the business side.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing. First of all, I know a lot of people that are at Scanline, completely disjointed in a lot of ways, right? And you guys have an incredible. Everyone that I know that are at Scanline are top of their game. Some of the best people around, right? Even Sally, who's no longer at Scanline, she was amazing, right? And so
she's still there, walking the halls.
She's in spirit. I mean, and the fact that you listen to her podcast, right? She sat there and she's like, it was a hard decision to leave, and Danny gave her the blessing to leave, right?
Exactly.
And that was the thing that's what makes it great, you know. So Danny and Stefan and those guys are there, like, but you still have, you know, on the producing side, right? I mean, I had Lisa Baru on, and she'll be on this podcast as well, and
awesome.
She's fantastic. But Lisa Spence.
Yes, you should have her.
I know. Lisa Spence is fantastic and one of the kindest, most gentle people. But like someone who taught me one of the hardest lessons I've ever learned is also, you know, there. And I learned a lot from Lisa. And then you've got, you know, Craig Tzielis, who's another amazing person, who, by the way, I think you are my best bet to convince.
I already did. I talked to him.
You did?
Yeah, I was listening to Sally.
You listened to the Sally one?
And then you were going on and saying, if anybody's out there and, you know, can talk to, and I walked over to his desk immediately. And so I will keep reminding him. And you just keep, you'll get together.
Okay.
He's
he's a hard nut.
Yeah, he
is.
He's
a hard nut.
Well, he's so humble because he is amazing, but It's because he really...
He hates to brag.
Well, he doesn't have to. His
He doesn't have to.
His what he renders on the screen speaks for itself.
Yes, but he hates to talk about himself.
I know, and he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to.
No. Actually, the whole podcast is not going to be about that. It's the whole podcast is going to be like, what the fuck have you been doing? Like, let's hang out. Why aren't we talking? And you're an amazing person, and that's fine. It's like, and I know he doesn't want to have that mic recorded, but let's pretend the mic's on.
Well, this
here.
Is two in a row. He's got the pushing, so
yeah, okay,
it'll happen.
Okay, but Greg Zadilas is another great person, and I know there's a lot of fantastic things about it. Actually, you know, I'd love to have Danny and Stefan on too. Their time, as I'm sure, is very, very limited. But when they're in LA, and it's like, hey, you know what? This is a good podcast. This would be fun for you guys to be on because people should get to know that part of him. You know, Scandline is a great place, and I think that people should know a little bit about him and what makes it special. Actually, you know, we mentioned a little bit about Flowline, but I would love Stefan to sit here and describe to people what Flowline is, make it like kind of uber technical in a weird way.
Well, that probably won't happen.
Really? You think so?
No, I think, you know, that's I mean, he likes to get technical, but you know, again, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but Flowline is it works.
Well, you know, we don't have to talk about, like, we can talk about how it works, but talk about the inspiration. Why were you inspired to do this? What was your
thing? Well, he has a great story for that.
Okay.
So
we'll leave that to him.
Exactly.
Leave that to him. Danny's also a great person. She's been in the industry for a long time. She's well known. She's done great things to inspire people and to care for people. And I think
I was the first one to teach her how to composite on the Grinch.
Oh, right.
And so she always brings that up. You taught me how to composite.
Wow.
Well, she's gone way beyond compositing, so.
Yeah. She's doing really, really well. Well, that's cool. So here you are. Now we're at the end of your career, and we talked about what you've done recently, which is Independence Day. How do you feel about it? You feel pretty good about it?
You know, I feel really good, especially the work that we did. I saw the movie.
Yep.
I saw it twice, actually,
uh-huh.
And I actually liked it better the second time, only because...
Why did you not like it the first time?
Because I felt the first half was just like...
It's like watching dailies?
No, it just... they chopped everything up, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
It just... You didn't really get a chance to breathe and see what was happening next or who this character was. And I think by the middle of the film to the end, once they set everything up and you kind of knew where you were, then it was much more enjoyable. But I just felt like it was just this roller coaster ride just to get us somewhere.
So the second time you saw it, you already knew that.
Yeah,
so it was easier to see.
And I really enjoyed it.
Gotcha.
Like the second time, because I didn't have to, like, what did he just say? Because, I mean, realistically, you know, we worked on the sequences we did, but they were cutting literally to the minute before the movie came out.
Oh, right.
And a lot of that was cutting shorter, because the cut that we had maybe 2 months ago compared to what aired, it felt like there was a little bit more room. And I talked to one of the writers. And he was like, the movie came in just around 2 hours. And he said there was like a 2 hour, 12 minute version, 12 minutes where just enough time to give you that he felt, you know, played a lot better and, you know, created a little bit more.
Interesting.
And it's amazing when you think of those things.
Yeah.
Like how much time or, you know, where you spend the time, where you don't, and those decisions can make or break a movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it, like you said, it's like, you know, 12 minutes. Well, 12 minutes is a lot of time, but if you space it out over 2 hours, it's actually just a little bit here, a little
or
bit
even
there.
Just the first part of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, that's really cool. What can you tell us more, a little bit about what you're doing next or?
I'm working.
You're already on to the next project.
Yeah, no, I was finishing up Independence Day, and I was in Vancouver working on the final delivery, and then actually shooting in Vancouver at the same time. So shooting during the day, going back to Scanline at night, filing shots.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, I was.
So
was
you were doing
crazy.
One movie in production and doing another movie in post production.
So, but it. You know, it was cool because it was all in Vancouver, so I was able to move around and The team up in Vancouver working on Independence Day, they had it covered. Like we had already gone through, and
you had a lot of trust in
them. Oh, complete. Yeah. And they were very helpful in allowing for me to have the time because Power Rangers is being supervised by Sean Faden.
Really?
Yes. He's production
Sean Faden, another veteran of Day After Tomorrow.
He was one of the CG soups on Day After Tomorrow.
Yep.
And worked with him at DD for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
And
brilliant guy.
And yeah, he's amazing. And to work with my friends and work with people that I know and it's really satisfying.
Yeah, of course.
And just being, we were there on the streets in this little fishing town in BC called Steveston. And, and I was doing my homework and like setting up shots for him the next day because he was like running all this stuff. And I presented to him. He's like, you're really helping me out. Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's so heartfelt because it's him,
Right, it's Sean.
He's not just giving me a line. And
awesome guy.
And he is totally, we just had a CineSync today and, pointing out some of the mistakes that we, errors in the render and like, is this how it's going to be? And no, this is, and totally understands the process and, just really happy.
Yeah. He's a really cool guy. Well, that's awesome. I didn't know that. That's fantastic. Thank you for telling me that. We're kind of getting towards the end, but I want to end it with a little bit of a story about Kauai.
I wish we were there now, eh?
Yeah. So in Kauai, and by the way, this, just to put it in perspective so you'll realize this, I was in Kauai, my wife was pregnant with my son, and my daughter was not yet three. She just turned 10, by the way.
I know, that's amazing.
So that's how long ago this was.
Wow.
And so I was in Kauai on vacation with my family, just my daughter and my pregnant wife, very newly pregnant wife, didn't show at all. She just, the only reason you knew she wasn't, she was pregnant because she wasn't drinking alcohol. So I was the only person drinking in the family at the time. And we were on our way home. And I was sitting there at the airport in Kauai. And I have a 2.5-year-old who needs to just roam around. Just like, ugh. And we're just waiting for the plane to go back to L.A. And so it was like, all right, well, let's go over here. And she was like, oh, look, there's a plane that landed and people coming in, coming off the plane. And so she's like, okay, we're going to watch people coming off the plane. And you were, I think, the first person that came off that plane. One of the first. And I was like, all right, I'm going to roll with this. Like, Brian Grill, welcome to Kauai. Because you just came off a plane from L.A. and you like greeted by someone who you hadn't seen. That was so weird.
It was so awesome.
Yeah.
And you were and where were you guys staying? You were up in?
We were not in Princeton.
Or Princeville.
Princeville. We were down on the southern side. I forgot where it was. But we had gone up to that area. And I was just telling you, like, oh, this is what the weather's like in the area.
And well, we had just purchased like a timeshare like through Starwood.
Uh-huh.
And this was the first time we were going on this property.
Mm-hmm.
And we had my family with me, my sister and my brother.
Right.
And my brother-in-law and sister-in-law. So it was like six of us, three couples.
Uh-huh.
And then saw you. And it was just like, it's such a small world.
Yeah.
Such a small world, yeah. And that's what I love about our industry is that we need to go to places like Kauai,
yeah,
to kind of recharge and to see people like you and your family.
But doesn't that happen all the time? Like I always feel like I randomly run into people, and then so much so, like Kauai is like the perfect example. Like I'm sitting here at a gate in Hawaii. And off comes Brian Grill, and I'm going to greet him like nothing's changed, right? But that happens enough times that I find myself in random locations, like I'm going to be in Switzerland or wherever, right? And I'm going to look around and it's like, I bet you I find someone from the industry. I bet you I know someone here. Always related. Like somehow there's something about the visual effects industry that we run into each other in random places. And we say it's a small world, but I think it really is a small world where we run into each other a lot.
Well, to be fair, after Apollo 13, I went to Hawaii, Maui.
Yeah.
And was at the Four Seasons.
Uh-huh.
And literally went from the day of delivery that night. I finished work at like 4 a.m, jumped on a plane at 7, went to Hawaii, mm-hmm. basically was locked up in my room for 2 days in this beautiful Hawaii mm-hmm. because I had been working such crazy hours.
You just needed some sleep.
And just needed room service and the blinds closed.
Yeah.
And so we were there at the Four Seasons. We were finally down by the pool, me and now my wife, Lori, who was working at DD at the time. And I'm sitting there, I'm in the pool relaxing, and then I see walking down the path is Rob Legato.
Oh my God. And seriously?
His two kids and his wife. They had just, like 2 days later, finished up, you know, his part on Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And that's where they were vacationing.
Oh,
and
my
I
God.
Was like, oh my God.
I can't escape it.
I can't escape it.
Yeah.
And so he didn't recognize me, and I was sitting there and then let him get situated. He finally got in the pool, and I just kind of swam up to him. And I said, hey, Rob, I think we have a walkthrough and in 2 hours with Carrie. And right. he like did a double take. He was like, whoa, what? And, uh-huh. and then luckily we didn't
That's
see
an
each
awesome
other
story.
After that. But so he can enjoy his time and we enjoyed our time. But
that's awesome.
But yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. I mean, I think that's a great thing. It's like the industry is small, but you get to recognize all these people and they all seem to cross paths in a lot of interesting ways.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know what to say other than, you know, we're kind of really, at least I feel we're really lucky, and it's really about, you know, not convincing, but being a part of the process and sure. trying to be there early enough so that we can help with the decision making so that, you know, you don't get caught at the end and yeah. then, you know, things have completely changed. And I just want to be helpful, especially when it comes to the filmmaking, what we do, because a lot of people don't understand.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people who think they do. And then there are a lot of people that do,
sure.
you know, and it's just a matter of making sure that the people that are making the decisions are the ones that do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. I'm going to wrap it up because I think you and I are had a lot of great conversations. I think we've got a lot of great content. Obviously,
yeah, thank
we've
you
already
very much.
Queued up several podcasts from Scanline people, so I'm glad we can I'm gonna lean on you to help me
I will
figure
do.
That out.
I will do my best, sir.
You'll do my best. Thank you. All right, so I am going to let the last bucket drop, and I really appreciate you being on here, Brian. And
well,
thank you so much.
Thank you.